I'm so glad you said that, because as you were talking about that, I thought, you know what? Why don't this is a great beer to have in the morning.
Yeah.
This is
waffle, Belgian waffles with syrup and salty, meaty bacon on the side.
Pints and Pairings is brought to you in part by We're Driving and The Beer Cave. Learn more about our sponsors at hopheadshead.com/pintsandpairings.
Hello and welcome to Pints and Pairings. I'm Curtis Taylor, also known as Hophead Said.
And I'm Jason Hendrick with Everybody's Hungry.
This is, I feel like, my early days on Happy Hour, where I had no idea what was going on. The spirits,
oh, no
wine,
research?
What, yeah, no, just because I was so brand new to it that I was playing the part of the newbie. And today I find myself in that seat again. I love coffee. I am a coffee appreciator, yet I am at the very entry level of coffee knowledge.
Which is exciting for me because, one, right after my intro, I was going to, you know, kind of get into what today's topic was, and I felt your excitement, almost anxiousness, and that's probably because of some of the coffee finally kicking in. But part of why we're talking about coffee, yeah, that little voice behind the mic mm-hmm. that you just heard is John Weir, owner and chief roaster of Beacon Coffee Company in Ventura, California. And today's whole theme is about coffee and how it integrates with beer. One, on a just delicious level of people gravitating towards new ingredients in their beer, but also why brewers are gravitating to this ingredient for their brewing lineup. So Welcome, John, to Pints and Pairings.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
It's a little different than some of the other shows that you and I have interacted on, where we're a little more free and casual. There may be a couple words that fly out in terms of how you view roasting.
Yeah, these things happen.
A little less savory than AM radio. But welcome to the show. You know, when we talk, typically, it's focused on a beer or a brewery. Today's show, we're going to have a little more flexibility and a little more range in terms of the beers we're drinking, because the theme is coffee, and you're an expert in that topic. So one of the things we want to focus on is the roasting process, but before that, some sourcing, because everything you teach us right now in this segment is going to lead into how coffee influences beer and brewing.
Sure. So the first thing that one needs to realize about coffee is that where coffee is grown is rather important to the final flavor that is available to the roaster, as it were, in order to develop those flavors in the roasting process. So most importantly, we need altitude in coffee in order to stress the coffee plant in an appropriate way. And that stressing of the plant at altitude directly relates to the density of what you and I refer to as the coffee bean.
Okay.
But in actuality, that is a seed inside of a fruit that is about the size of a cranberry.
And it's called the cherry, right?
That's right. Yeah. It's in the coffee cherry. And that grows on a plant that traditionally should be somewhere between 12 and 14 to 16 feet tall. And those plants grow in the best conditions, mostly on the side of mountains, somewhere between 2,000 feet and 6,000 feet.
So, Curtis, I would deem that somewhat of a prestigious plant then. If it's growing on a mountainside at altitude overlooking vistas, then it should get its due, right?
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing that I've learned at one point, and you're reminding me of it, that you're not going to go to your local garden store
or orchard, and then
go plant this in your backyard, unless of course you're living on the side of a mountain, which is hard enough to do.
Living on the side of a mountain between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn,
that's ideal.
Yeah,
that we know that there are ideal. Some people who have tried to grow coffee outside of that realm.
Oh, there's a gentleman who's trying to do this up in Goleta, just north of Santa Barbara, and certainly it's an interesting experiment because, agronomically speaking, one should be able to produce coffees or other plants that are normally grown at altitude when close to the equator at slightly less altitude because of how the angle of the sun works.
Okay. Oh.
So theoretically it is possible, but unlike beer and unlike wine and unlike distilling, we don't, there's no coffee university out there yet, and there's nowhere to go and get a PhD in coffee sciences.
Well, I was just actually telling Curtis that in our opening segment, because you and I were just on a show this morning talking about coffee,
right.
And I was not aware at how infant the coffee industry is in terms of its own scientific advancements.
Exactly, exactly. So Brazil is really the only place that is at the forefront of coffee and approaching it from a scientific manner. That said, their science is all based on the agronomy side of how do we automate the growing and the picking and the processing side of it.
It's not on the nuances of the bean.
No one has started to do this, the real hard science of breaking down exactly what acids are being formed during the roasting process, at what temperature and at what time.
Interesting.
So, you know, we as an industry get new science every year, and we try to stay plugged into that as much as possible. But there is this point in our industry where the science and the art have to come together.
Sure.
And it's only through marrying the two processes well and understanding, you know, both the scientific as it stands and the art side of it and understanding their contributions that one can get consistently beautiful coffees out of the roaster.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I look forward to in this development of the coffee industry is seeing how that science and knowledge base in the brewing industry, for instance, has traveled down through the ranks into homebrewers, where we have the same kind access to that same kind of knowledge of the chemistry and the biology of all these ingredients that we're using, that it just, you know, that's what helps me make such a great beer, is because of my understanding of that. And this coffee tastes great already, but looking 10 or 15 years down the road, when somebody decides to finally put all this together, I'm just thinking about what the quality of this of a coffee drink will be in 10 years from now.
Well, I think we've seen this across a lot of different foods and beverages that we talk about on the show, and just progression in general, that an appreciation for the product and a knowledge of the product just really adds to the value of what you're eating and drinking. And the experience, you know, being able to share out, like you're doing with us, your passion and knowledge of that product is really important.
And only through creating a customer base that yearned for something that was better than a cup of hot brown liquid, you know. So we do have to doff our caps, as it were, a bit to three Berkeley College kids who really fell in love with Alfred Peet's coffee, and then they went home to Seattle and said, I really miss good coffee, so we should get a storefront and we should sell whole bean coffee and tea. And, you know, that was almost 35 years ago, and that company is Starbucks now.
Well, you make an interesting point, John, and what I want to equate it to, Curtis, is a few shows that we've done that are available in our archives, and that's the Bud Malheur's Challenge. You know, we often have fun with Bud Malheur's drinkers versus craft beer drinkers and that whole kind of warring philosophy, right, of what defines good beer versus bad beer. But at the very minimum, we've talked about the industry leaders at that time and the effort they went through. You know, Budweiser, Miller, and Coors all started as somebody wanting to brew beer,
yeah,
at one level, and they've gone through the automation and the science of it. So although we don't typically endorse those beers in our own manner, they still brought a lot to the table for the industry as a whole. And we can joke about Starbucks,
metaphorically speaking, they provided an incredibly firm bedrock of a foundation for growth, you know,
and Starbucks, for desire for knowledge from the consumer.
Sure.
Base.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, educated customers can certainly challenge process.
Sure.
And that's a good thing. It's a good thing having customers come in and know more than just, I want a hotter, browner liquid, you know, so, when we get folks coming in, you know, asking us what's the difference between how you do things and how Starbucks does things. It's much the same, I would imagine, to the difference between, say, the Sam Adams of the world and the Institution Ales of the world.
Sure.
It's a matter of scalability.
Now, when someone asks that question, do you typically look at them and say, well, how much time do you have? Because I imagine that, again, knowing your background... and
I like to never give anybody an opportunity to tell me they don't have time for the explanation.
Touche, touche.
You came in, and I'm going to tell you.
And that's the thing. So, and I can tell when you are ready to be checked out of the conversation. And at that point, it's a real sense of barista power to say, well, I can let him out of this conversation now gracefully, or I can keep him here for another 5 minutes.
I know they've got somewhere to go, but...
And we don't want to lose sight of the new guest that just sat down in your camera view as well, and your better half on many occasions, John.
She's more than half, actually. I think she might be like my better three quarters.
Yeah, so right now we're talking to owner of Beacon Coffee Company and chief roaster John Weir, but co-owner of Beacon Coffee and chief of operations, Jen Weir, just sat down, and we want to welcome you to the conversation as well, Jen.
Thanks. I'm glad that you guys came. This is going to be a really fun show.
Yeah, so right now, Jen, kind of what we've been getting into with John is kind of the foundation of coffee and, you know, where it typically is grown. And we're going to move into some of the things that we can learn about coffee once it's picked and moving into the roasting cycle, because that's going to give us the foundation for these beers that we're going to taste in the next segments. But I do want to ask, you have to be a coffee lover to run a coffee shop, and you definitely handle the front of the house. When it comes to customer interaction, and like John was saying, they come in, they want to know why you do things differently or what that means. How do you interpret the customer education process and, you know, leading them through this journey of craft coffee?
Well, I think it has to be approachable for sure. Not to intimidate or, you know, make anyone feel like, you know, whatever they're doing at home or whatever they enjoy or however they're enjoying their coffee is not, you know, the right way. So just through education, we feel like that's the best way to kind of get our ideas and views across, and letting them know how important it is to us, the whole process, and, you know, going down to the farms and seeing how hard everyone's working and how much goes into it. They start to understand a little bit why maybe we don't do blended drinks or, you know, put the coffee through a process where it's going to get covered up with a bunch of other stuff.
Sure.
So, I mean, but yeah, I think people really appreciate coming in and learning more about seeing the actual roasting process, but also learning more about how the coffee is grown and more about the people that are growing it. So.
Excellent. So, Curtis, we talked about where it's grown, but... we're kind of indulging already with some beer that has coffee in it. We need to know about the coffee by itself that we want to drink.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, lead us through a little bit of the roasting cycle. So you bring in green beans from South America or Ethiopia.
Sure.
And what is that green bean? What can you get from that just in its basis?
So when we're starting with a raw coffee bean or seed, it's been dry processed and prepared for the roasting process by the time it hits our shores.
Okay.
What's important to note is that there's no flavor in green coffee yet.
But there's aroma, right?
There's nothing. Dry coffee in by itself or raw coffee by itself, sometimes it has a little bit of a grassy smell or a little bit of a hay smell. Mm-hmm. But those are not smells that are going to contribute to the ultimate roasted flavor of the coffee. What you're looking at when you're looking at the raw coffee is potential.
Okay.
And the sugars that are trapped inside of that very dense, hard, raw green coffee need to be softened through heat and time to the point where all of the free moisture that's inside of that coffee bean has escaped.
So it's concentrated, almost like a grape on the vine for a little too long, where it's just the moisture's gone, but what we want to tap into is left.
Right, exactly. So if we're talking in terms of the actual roasting process, then in the first 3 to 4 minutes of the roasting process, out of a total 12 to 15 minutes, all we're doing is leaching all of the free moisture that's still in the seed out of the seed.
Okay.
And then something audible starts to happen inside of the roasting chamber. And we start to hear a crack, almost like the popping of popcorn. And what that is the final bit of free moisture escaping by the actual cellulose structure of the bean breaking apart and allowing that water vapor to escape. It is at that point that we're actually roasting the coffee.
Interesting.
And it's okay. Important.
So there's technically not a roast happening. It's really just drying out the bean and to a point where it can then move on to a roasting phase.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. But one can't get to the roasting without the drying.
Fair enough.
Right. So how one controls the speed at which the coffee dries affects how much heat one can give the roaster in order to incite the caramelization process of the sugars that are now left in the bean itself.
Now, Curtis, that went over my head a little bit. Did you grasp that one?
Well, it's...
I have a visual, but I want to make sure I get it right.
I'm drawing parallels to malt drying and how malt is dried to a certain
moisture content,
and then it's kilned, and then as you know, whether there's still some moisture left in the bean, then the sugars develop inside the husk, or they're left to in just the flavor components that are built through that kilning process. So I mean, I'm there
okay.
a little bit, but
well, maybe you can expand a little bit more though, John. And like, so if we went a higher heat for a shorter amount of time or lower heat for a longer amount of time, is that where you're getting at? Like, what are the impacts of those variables?
In the beginning, we don't have enough time in one radio show to break down all of the nuances
of
roasting.
And I tell you, Curtis, the knowledge that John is oozing right now definitely is more than I'll have in a lifetime.
Suffice it to say, like with many things in baking, if you dry something out a little bit slower and in a controlled way, that has a tendency when dealing with long-chain sugars to lead toward sweeter ends.
Okay.
Okay. So as we move out of the drying phase and into the roasting and caramelization phase of the roasting process, then we have to really control the rate at which we are caramelizing, or all of that work that we've done to carefully dry it to just where we want it so that it cracks and pops and starts to caramelize at the time we want that to happen. If we give it too much heat at the wrong time, we can burn those sugars right off.
Got it. That makes sense.
Right.
Now. Okay.
So the nuance and the flavor and everything that we've tasted at origin when we decided to buy the coffee, that's all going to happen from first crack through the end of the roasting process. Okay. And it is in that part of we call it the roast development cycle, right before first crack, through the end of the roasting cycle, that we can either elongate by slowing it down and flattening out the temperature curve to favor sweetness, or we can shorten that roast development time in an effort to focus more on the acidity and the brightness of a given coffee.
This is one of those science meets the art form, and so understanding these temperature ranges, and you know, it's what it's sounding like to me is down to the second, if it's, you know, the tens of seconds, or now even down to the second on your timer, to put your scientific knowledge to test to create this beautiful work of art, which is this perfectly roasted coffee bean, meeting your flavor specs that you're trying to produce.
Correct. And those potential flavors are either in there or they're not in there. And it's the roaster's job to unlock them in a way that represents the coffee in its best light. And that's why, from a philosophical standpoint, here at Beacon, we try to unlock enough of the coffee so that when you're tasting it, you're tasting where it's from, not how it was roasted.
Interesting.
And that isn't a judgment on folks who do that a different way. And oftentimes, I mean, I think since we're kind of in a bit of a foodie circle here, I think it's an appropriate way to say this. I'm originally from Texas. I love slow-cooked 36-hour brisket.
Yeah.
But I would never do that to Wagyu beef. Right? I would never do that to the finest meat on the planet, because then you wouldn't taste why that's the finest meat on the planet. So some cuts are good for smoking, and some cuts are good for having crudo.
Fair enough.
And some coffees are built to be added and blended with other coffees so that together they represent something bigger than they are separate. And some coffees are so phenomenal by themselves that you can focus on just a single estate coffee. What we don't have that wine has and that beer has is we haven't gotten as an industry really down into the varietal and saying, this is what a typica tastes like when grown in Costa Rica. This is what a typica tastes like when grown in Guatemala, and so on and so forth.
And, you know, and the different elevations, the different...
Correct.
You know, the microclimates of the vineyards around here, just, it's mind-boggling what they're doing. You know, and that might be a closer parallel to the wine, whereas, you know, grain or barley is grown in the northern part of the hemisphere, and it, you know, that's what it is. But then that comes down to the grain is really the maltsters. You know, that's where those flavors come from, similar to you, where these beans are coming to you. You get to decide what the flavor of that finished product is.
Sure. I think this is leading us down a good path to you, Curtis. We have some beers with coffee in them, and I think we're kind of at a junction, just from my own feeling, that we should drink some of these beers and continue the discussion about not like the beer just by itself in terms of featuring that beer and brewery, but John's impressions of the coffee in the beer and see how that influences some of the stuff we've been talking about right now. So let's take a quick break, fill our glasses with something tasty, and we'll come back and get John's impressions on some of these breweries.
Perfect.
Pints and Pairings is brought to you in part by The Beer Cave, located at 231 Village Commons Boulevard in Camarillo, California.
If you prefer a cocktail or some vino, this neighborhood market also has a great selection of premium spirits and wine, along with an attached deli for a quick sandwich to go.
When you stop in, be sure to mention that you heard about them right here on The Pints and Pairings Show, and maybe grab a sandwich for me on your way out.